Good afternoon. I'm Jim Mason, president of Parental Rights Foundation. You can visit our website at parentalrightsfoundation.org. Today, it's my pleasure to welcome Richard Wexler. He's the executive director of National Coalition for Child Protection Reform. Richard and I are both members of a cross-ideological coalition of people who agree that the child protection business in America needs reform. Welcome, Richard. Do you still think it needs reform?
More than ever. And thanks very much for having me.
So, Richard, you are the author of a very influential book that has been out now for a long time. And I read it when I first came to work here almost 20 years ago, Wounded Innocence. Tell us how you got involved in this topic, wrote the book, and then came on to the position you're in now.
Sure. Thank you. At the time I wrote the book, that was during my what I call my first career as a journalist. And I first covered child welfare, covered my first child welfare story when I was a journalism student in 1976. And for that story, I interviewed a college student. She was 21 at the time, but she had been in 9 different foster homes by the time she was 9 years old. And she talked about how she had survived that trauma by keeping the rage bottled up inside her, as she put it, unlike my 5 brothers who have been in every jail in New York State. And I came out of interviewing her for 2.5 hours with a couple of conclusions. I was really glad I had chosen journalism as a career, and I knew I was going to keep coming back to the story. As I did, I kept finding that the facts on the ground weren't matching what the most widely quoted experts kept saying. They would say, well, you know, child abuse crosses class lines. And I'd think, okay, how come I only see poor people in this system? And when those dichotomies became too much to bear, as I learned that there was a much wider range of expertise than was getting into most news stories, ultimately, I wrote that book, Wounded Innocence. The book was the bridge into advocacy. Our founder, the late Betty Vorenberg, who had been active in child welfare and civil liberties issues, and whom I'd known when I was a reporter in Massachusetts, asked if I wanted to form an organization around the principles in the book. I said, sure. And a mere 8 years later, we got sufficient foundation funding for me to take the only job I've ever had that does not involve either committing acts of journalism or teaching journalism. So that, the book, as I say, was the bridge to what I do now.
What's the mission of the National Coalition for Child Protection Reform? And what do you see as the state of things today compared to what it was when you began?
Well, what we work to do is to curb needless removal of children from their families. We don't believe there are no circumstances in which children need to be taken, but many, many fewer can be taken than are taken now. So we seek to curb the enormous harm that is done by needless foster care. And the only way to fix that is to stop taking so many children. The area on which we have been most focused is the confusion of poverty with neglect. Broad, vague neglect laws. Your typical neglect statute is lack of adequate food, clothing, and shelter. That is a perfect definition of poverty. So what we work on is explaining the nature of the system to the public, changing child welfare by changing media coverage of child welfare, and building a system that stops inflicting so much needless trauma on families. And at the same time, when you stop inflicting all that needless trauma, when workers aren't deluged with false reports, trivial cases, poverty confused with neglect allegations, they have more time to actually find those very few children in real danger. The current system, what we have now, makes all children less safe. A reformed system increases safety for all children.
On my Facebook page the other day, someone left a comment that said, oh, don't support this organization. They want to dismantle child welfare. Is that what you want to do? Is that what I want to do?
No, I want to rebuild the system. I want to create, there's a lot of talk now, and it needs to be understood. That's similar to the talk about groups about, quote, abolishing the system. I agree with that. But abolition doesn't mean having nothing. That is a straw man. That is a false argument by those who don't want to face how much harm the existing system does. What we need is a system that stops confusing poverty with neglect, that is no longer riven by the racial bias that permeates the existing children, the existing system, and thereby hurts the children in it. And then that frees up resources to find those very few children who are in real danger.
So this confusion of poverty with neglect is, you know, in your book, you talk about, and you're probably one of the better experts on the Mondale Act. How did this, I mean, this is the current iteration of child welfare. In your book, you go through the long historical development of it, but tell us about the Mondale Act and how that kind of set into motion what we have today.
There were a whole slew of things that led us to where we are, but one piece of it was what's called the Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act. And what happened there was Senator Walter Mondale had been actually trying to pass a bill for universal child care or something along those lines, helping with basically poor families being able to get child care and other help with child development. Richard Nixon vetoed that. And he and others in Congress, which was controlled by Democrats at the time, realized that anything along those lines, anything that targeted poverty, was going to face that kind of a veto. So as Mondale put it, even Richard Nixon isn't in favor of child abuse. So therefore they constructed this Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act, which in terms of what it actually did was a very small, very minor offshoot of the system. However, it created this mentality that child abuse is rampant, that it has nothing to do with poverty, that there's a child abuser under every bed, essentially. And even though the amount of money involved under the Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act, the amount of money you could get if you complied with its provisions was very small, the provisions included things like having to have a mandatory reporting law to require anyone and everyone to report anything and everything. It has been made worse over the years. So now it criminalizes almost any poor parent who uses drugs during pregnancy, for example. It requires that they be turned into Child Protective Services. And then perhaps the most important thing is what happened in order to get it passed. The supporters of the act deliberately misrepresented the nature of the problem. When witnesses wanted to talk at hearings about this, about poverty, they wouldn't let them. They kept directing them away from that idea. So we have this whole concept that what we call child abuse is both rampant and it's some kind of a public health problem in which all these rampant child abusers, if they're not evil, are certainly sick. Now, some cases involve people who are evil. Some cases involve people who are sick. But overwhelmingly, we are talking about people caught up in this net because they are poor. And we know that even small additional infusions of cash can make a huge difference. So for example, one of my favorite studies showed that, not surprisingly, if you provided housing vouchers to poor families, child removal in those families was cut in half. Why? Because one of the biggest single sources of neglect reports is lack of adequate housing. Now, interestingly, if you provided the housing vouchers plus a social work intervention, required families to jump through all sorts of hoops, get counseling, it didn't work as well. So what is needed is more cash, less social work. And it doesn't require vast amounts. The housing vouchers cost less than foster care, which costs way less than group homes, which costs way less than institutions. But these were the kind of solutions that were derailed by CAPTA, the Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act.
So I did a deposition. So I'm a lawyer, and the way I don't do acts of journalism, or at least random acts of journalism, I guess podcasting might be considered a half-baked random act of journalism. I do random acts of lawsuits, and I sued I sued some CPS workers a few years ago, and it ended up resulting in a $700,000 settlement for my client, who was poor and was misunderstood and had her children taken away for a misunderstanding, the CPS investigator's misunderstanding of the medical condition of her four-year-old child. And during the deposition, and I think this might resonate with you, during a deposition of one of the people who were there during the child removal, was actually an intern who had just been kind of taken along as a, quote, training exercise and to add additional bodies. By the time we got to her deposition, she was no longer working for the CPS agency. And so I said, well, why did you leave? And she was kind of a middle-aged woman who had gone back to school. And she said, I went back to school because I wanted to do social work. And that's not social work. So, you know, how do you respond to that?
Well, I'm very impressed. She did the right thing. There are a lot of very good people in the system who want to do real social work, who want to help, but they too are trapped in a system in which all of the incentives go the other way. And it begins with, coming back to CAPTA, mandated reporting. So anyone and everyone who works with children in most states, in some states technically everyone, is required to report their slightest suspicion of pretty much anything. Now, this was put in place even before CAPTA. It was started as far back as the late 1960s. CAPTA demanded it of every state. And it was done with no study beforehand. Nobody ever tried to, let's try it in one region, not do it in another, see which makes kids safer. No, it was just assumed that if you did this, that would work. That flooded the system, collapsed what was available, took in all these families needlessly. And now that they're finally doing research on this all these years later, we're seeing two things. First, sure enough, the overload of the system with all these nonsense reports is in fact stealing workers' time from finding children in real danger. But what else is interesting is it discourages families from seeking voluntary help. They are afraid to reach out to any helpers, to the good social workers out there who might be in their school or in another agency, people who want to help because they're afraid, rightly, unfortunately, of being turned in. So the mandated reporting laws have backfired. As many people have known for decades, some of the original proponents turned against those laws very quickly, seeing what was happening. But we are still stuck with those. And that is discouraging people from reaching out for help. And that is making it harder for the good social workers to do good social work.
Makes it hard for lawyers too, because, you know, when people call us, our conversations are privileged and we don't have to report about past events. But if someone's really struggling, it's difficult to advise them how to go about getting help. Mm-hmm. Even pastors in some states are mandatory reporters unless they're acting in the confessional category or a pastoral counseling. So what do you, these mandatory reporting laws, do you have any idea of the statistics, how many reports are made and how many are end up actually being what we would think of as child abuse?
Yes. Out of every 100 calls nationwide that are made to child abuse hotlines, mostly those will come from mandated reporters, but also from people who just think they're doing the right thing. And sometimes they are doing the right thing. But out of every 100 calls, 91 are either so absurd they are screened out at the hotline and not even investigated, or after they are investigated, they turn out to be false reports. Even the workers think so. Now, a few things to understand there. To label a report true doesn't mean there was a court hearing and a judge or a jury. A quote true report simply means the worker checked a box on the form saying, I think it's at least slightly more likely than not that it happened. That's all it takes. And yet all these reports turn out to be false. Now, there are people who will say, oh, but some of those, some cases, they really did it. The families really did it and they weren't caught. It's true. But the only study I know of that's ever been done of this, which is quite old, but it's the only one I know, says workers are 2 to 6 times more likely to wrongly substantiate an allegation than to wrongly label it unfounded. So 91 out of 100 is, if anything, an understatement. So what about the rest? Well, another 6, the worker checks the box that says it's a, quote, substantiated, unquote, case of neglect. Now, neglect can be extremely serious in very rare cases. You can lock a child in a closet and starve him to death, and that's neglect. If the food stamps run out at the end of the month, that's also neglect. And I think we can pretty well guess which happens more often. So most of those, so now you're up to 97 out of 100. Only 3 out of 100 are any form of physical abuse, from the most mild to the most severe, and sexual abuse. So overwhelmingly, you are traumatizing families needlessly, and workers are spinning their wheels, not having time to find those needles in the haystack, those among the 3% where if you don't get there in time, something really serious is going to happen.
So what do we do about this?
Well, there are a whole series of things. My own view, number one, and I think as a lawyer you will appreciate this, is more lawyers. And what I mean by that is, back when I wrote the book, I had all sorts of recommendations for changing laws, and I stand by those. But what I came to realize over the, and it's been 25 years, even since the most recent edition of that book came out, is the laws aren't any good if there's no one to enforce them. And what has shown tremendous success is high quality legal representation for families. And of course, that overwhelmingly means it's going to have to be free legal representation because overwhelmingly the families can't afford private attorneys. And what that means is the family gets a defense team, a lawyer, their own social worker, to craft an alternative to the cookie cutter service plans that agencies love, and sometimes a parent advocate, somebody who's been through the system. And the workers have reasonable, and all of them have reasonable caseloads. And we know when you do it that way, because New York City, for a variety of reasons, has wound up with an extensive model of doing it just this way. We know it significantly reduces foster care with no compromise of safety. And it serves as a backstop against political, against whatever is in the news that week. So if you have high quality family defenders in every case, it's harder for agencies to engage in what I call foster care panic. There's a high profile case in the news, a death of a child known to the system. Every worker is terrified. The politicians are demanding that you take away more children. High quality family defense helps reduce that as well. So that's my number one recommendation. Of course, we also need to repeal mandatory reporting. We need to repeal CAPTA because it has so many provisions that do tremendous harm. I mean, the only good thing about CAPTA is there's not much money attached to it. So fortunately, states are not sacrificing much if they don't comply with its most onerous provisions. But of course, now there are plans to try to bulk up CAPTA and put more money behind it, making it even more dangerous. The other law that needs to go is the so-called Adoption and Safe Families Act, which was a law meant to enshrine a take the child and run mentality. It's meant to encourage you to believe in the system that child removal equals child safety. And then once in the system, it encourages agencies to rush to terminate children's rights to their parents. Now, the usual term for that is termination of parental rights, but we should speak of it as what it is, terminating children's rights to their parents. So that law needs to go, CAPTA needs to go. We need high quality family defense. Good news on that one is the federal government will now pay half the cost of that defense in many cases, which may, I hope, encourage more communities to adopt it. We also need to confront the racial bias that permeates the system. And one of the ways we know that bias is there, aside from all the studies, is a fascinating program that was conducted in suburban New York City in which they created what they call blind removal meetings. What that means is before a child could be removed, the case had to be presented to a committee, but they took out any information about the family's race or even where the family lived, so you wouldn't get a clue about the family income. When they did that, removals of Black children dropped dramatically. So we need to deal with the racism. We absolutely should narrow the neglect laws, but even more important is someone to defend against it. We need to repeal ASFA. We need to repeal CAPTA. We need to focus our energies and our resources on basic concrete help to keep families together.
Well, that should be easy.
Well, one step at a time.
Yeah.
As you know, United Family Advocates has been supporting a bill that would at least take a small first step. And that's Representative Gwen Moore's bill to at least suspend a key. One of the provisions of ASFA is if a child has been in foster care for 15 of the previous 22 months, regardless of whether the child ever should be been taken in the first place, regardless of whether it was basically the agency's failure that keeps the child there, nevertheless, when that 15-month clock runs out, you're supposed to petition for termination of children's rights to their parents. What this bill Representative Moore has introduced says is, look, at least don't do that when you're in the middle of a public health crisis, when obviously everything is slowed down and stalled. So that would be a small first step in the right direction.
So as I've done these podcast interviews over the last 2 years or so, I've described this issue as interestingly bipartisan in both directions. Is it, Richard, that, I mean, you and I probably are quite different in our political yep. outlook and ideological outlook as well. But how is it that you and I can be on the same side and people that I tend to agree with more politically and people you would agree with more politically are on the opposite side of this thing? How is it so uniquely, doubly bipartisan?
Well, as you said, bipartisan in both directions. And I think it's because what it really reveals is there are differences within left and right. I like to say that the best way to get some of my fellow liberals to renounce everything they claim to believe in is to whisper the words child abuse in their ears. All of a sudden, all their demands for due process, all their demands for limiting government intrusion on the civil liberties of individuals go out the window. But there are people on the left from a civil liberties background who understand that. Similarly, on the right, you have the libertarian right, which understands that that big government is a problem even when you call what they're fighting to be child abuse. Conversely, you have social conservatives of the Newt Gingrich mold who say, take away poor people's kids and put them into orphanages. So it took the worst of left and right to create this system. It's going to take the best of both to fix it.
Well, speaking of left and right and best and worst, recently, so my other hat I wear is Vice President of Homeschool Legal Defense Association, and Harvard professor Elizabeth Barthollet famously wrote a law review article calling for the presumptive ban of homeschooling, and we wrote a significant number of responses to her. Her law review article had many things to respond to in it. I came to learn, though, that you have had longstanding disagreement with Professor Elizabeth Barthollet of Harvard Law School on this topic. Tell us about that.
Mm-hmm. Sure. The column that I wrote for NCCPR's child welfare blog concerning that article, that law review article, was basically that Professor Barthollet's crusade against homeschooling isn't really about homeschooling. It's simply another aspect of what she's done throughout her career, which is to campaign for the mass confiscation of children. Mm-hmm. Her position is so extreme that she has suggested mandatory government intrusion onto every family in the form of home visiting. Now, this perverts what is in fact an excellent program. There are programs to provide home visiting to families on a voluntary basis. And in which a family that needs help can have somebody come, people to come in, experts to visit a family. Very often they are trained in nursing. And these are really good programs. But then Bartlett comes along and says, make it mandatory for every family. And she very specifically says, do it for surveillance. So she wants a spy in every living room. That's how extreme this is. If you look at her definitions of how many children need to be taken away, it would come to at least 2 million children every year. So this has been the thrust of all of her advocacy. So the reason she wants kids in school doesn't have to do with education. I'm not saying she's against having kids educated, but she wants them in school for that surveillance. She wants them constantly watched so they can be turned in by the mandated reporters. That's her problem with homeschooling. It's not really related to education.
So I've talked with a couple of professors, most recently Josh Gupta-Kagan, and let's talk about the hidden foster care. You've written about this and know about it. It seems like that's a tremendous problem today in the way that CPS investigators and others deal with issues.
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing with hidden foster care, here's how that works. What would happen is Child Protective Services might come to your home and they might say, well, we don't like what's going on here. And you have a choice. We can either, you can voluntarily agree that we will tell that you can give up your child to a relative, place the child, usually this will be with an aunt or with grandma or something like that. But if you say no to our voluntary offer, we will take all the children and place them with strangers. So it's not exactly really voluntary. But they will claim it is, and having done it that way, and it varies from state to state, community to community, they will stash the child away with grandma, and they won't even report it as an entry into foster care. So for example, in the state of Texas, if you look at their official figures, it looks like their rate of removal is low. But nearly two-thirds of their removals are off the books. They're done that way. They're done through hidden foster care.
Speaking of Texas, I just did a case in Texas where a report of, I guess you'd call it neglect or something. The report was that a mom was seen to put a 8-month-old baby down for a nap in a closet where the baby cried, according to the report, excessively. The CPS investigator visited the home. Mom showed the baby to the investigator on the front porch wearing only a diaper. And in the petition that the investigator filed with the court, said the baby appeared to be healthy, clean, and well cared for. Nevertheless, she asked for an order from a court to direct the family to allow her into the home to check out. And they always want to check more than just the actual allegations, of course. And to remove all of the other kids for forensic interviews at the office. And fortunately, we were able to get involved and we filed a writ of mandamus with the Texas Court of Appeals. And they they gave us an emergency stay and unanimously said that these allegations are not sufficient to justify government intrusion into the family. What kind of legal efforts are you aware of, and what can we do to make this system better with the tools we have?
Well, the first thing I would say is, I'd like everybody to think about that cries excessively. Imagine, is there anybody who might not have had their baby removed at some point based on a status of somebody from the outside saying cries excessively? I have no idea what that means. At one time or another, almost every baby cries a lot. So in terms of what can be done about that, here again, we need, what was done about it in this case was, she had you as a liar. So what we need is for every family to be able to call a lawyer, regardless of income, right at the moment the CPS worker is at the door, because even the high quality programs I mentioned in New York City, it tends to come after that. What's needed is the ability to have somebody on call immediately to say, no, I'm not going to let you into the house, but here's my phone. You can talk to my lawyer, and who could say, no, you can't do that. Now, in this particular case, they say they went back to court, at which point they should have been met by counsel who would say, you have a perfectly healthy baby here. It's nobody's business. And if somebody converts a closet into a nursery and you see the baby and the baby's just fine, go move on to the next case where some child might be in real danger.
Isn't that the tragedy of this? Because what I've run into this in numerous cases, this one's not the first. What happens once they open an investigation, you talked about it, that sometimes they're screened out, but once they open an investigation, they're not there to determine that the allegations are true or false. In their minds, the investigators' minds, they are there to determine that the child is safe. And they cannot, in their minds, do that without, quote, completing their investigation. So it doesn't really matter that they learn things, you know, like, oh, the baby's really healthy and this is a nice enough baby. That's really none of my business. They don't, that's not how they view it. And the other tragic thing is judges who review these petitions from the CPS investigators do not do their jobs.
And this is, again, why they need to be held accountable case by case. The judges and the caseworkers are in some ways in a similar position in the sense that the judge can rubber stamp caseworkers hundreds, thousands of times. The children will suffer terribly for that. But you know who's safe? The judge and the caseworker. If the judge applies the law one time, and it turns out this was one of those times when nobody could have known, and there is a terrible tragedy, then that judge may be on the front page of the local paper saying, why did this judge leave that child home to die? So therefore, enormous trauma is inflicted on children through wrongful removal, through needless investigations. And let's remember, investigations often are accompanied by strip searches of the children. I mean, if anyone else did it, it would be sexual abuse. So all that trauma is inflicted, and you've actually increased the chance that some child down the line will be missed. But the judge who has the paperwork in front of him, who has the caseworker in front of him, who often does not have someone from the other side in front of him or her, is safer in terms of her or his own career by rubber stamping the removal.
Yeah, so all of the incentives of the system operate in the wrong direction. And the sincerely concerned person making a valid report is kind of lost in the sea of all of these reports, and the investigator having to all of these reports, and the judges kind of rubber stamping all of these petitions. And that, so that the, you know, one of my favorite law review articles is written by a Duke law professor named Dorian Coleman. And she writes a sentence in the law review article that says something like, in the hopes of protecting some children, the state does enormous harm to many more children than it helps.
Exactly. Exactly. Because again, not only do you have the harm done to the children who are needlessly torn from everyone they know and love, confined to the chaos of foster care, often bounced from home to home, emerging years later, unable to love or trust anyone. You have all those where it doesn't go that far, but they still will be terrified, particularly if they are young children, after the worker has come to the door, poked through cupboards and refrigerators, searched every room and possibly strip searched them and asked them terribly intimate questions about the most personal aspects of their lives. And again, that's all being stolen from finding those relatively few children in real danger. So yes, it does do much more harm to many more children.
And there's an enormous opportunity for education of officials in this area that they have an actual responsibility to protect children from this system. I mean, their obligation isn't just to, there's sort of an assumption that, and this is another deposition quote or near quote, the investigator that was principally responsible for the removal of a child and the county ended up paying $700,000 testified at her deposition that, oh, it's not that big of a deal to kids. They're resilient. You know, they'll just bounce right back. And that was her testimony after she went out to a house, had a sheriff's deputy restrain the mom while she tore the screaming 4-year-old diabetic girl out of the house. And you know, it took us, this is the other thing that really bothers me. The system is designed not to quickly resolve the issues because we had the treating pediatric endocrinologist standing by to testify at the 3-day hearing, and the judge wouldn't allow it because, well, the 3-day hearing is really just to determine whether the petition itself, if true, would amount to child abuse. So anyway, I'm ranting now because
all I can say is, what planet is that caseworker on? I have to wonder, could she picture if she has children? Surely she knows what it's like or would be like for a stranger to come to the door that way and behave that way and take the child and strip the child and possibly in some cases walk away with the child. I mean, there are accounts of young people who very much remember this and write about how they remain scared for years afterward of any knock at the door. Parents will speak often of children who become afraid. Sometimes police are called when they see a police officer. Instead of seeing that as someone who can help, they're afraid because that's who took them last time. Or the sound of a siren might send them scurrying under the bed. So no, this is tremendous trauma. And it stuns me that, I mean, I know workers don't get much training, but they really should have picked up on that.
Yeah, I agree. Sadly, I mean, she had been in the business for a long time, middle-aged woman, she had no children, but that's what she said. And it's not that uncommon experience.
I find it interesting when workers say, well, kids are resilient. Okay, does that mean it's okay for a parent to say, break a child's arm? Because after all, you put it in a cast and a sling and it'll get better. You still don't hurt a child.
Right.
So no, it is still child abuse to deliberately break a child's arm. Whether the child will heal or not, it is child abuse to inflict a needless investigation on a child, whether the child will heal or not.
One of the more frustrating things about this business, as well as a lot of businesses, is the true nature of things is often hidden behind euphemisms. So you've said strip search, and it's our experience that, you know, lots of investigations wind up with being strip searched. In another case I'm working on in Kentucky, we discovered, I mean, I knew this, but this was made a big deal, actually. Oh, no. It's not strip searching. What we do is 10-4 body checks. And, you know, so removing a child's clothing isn't strip searching them. It's doing a body check. And the testimony in the case was that it's routinely done, and especially with younger children, 4 years old and younger. No matter what the allegations are, if you got the kid, you do the quote body check.
Mm-hmm.
That's just, you know, a stranger shows up at the door, official or not, and tells mommy that you got to turn the kid over to this stranger, and the stranger takes off your clothing. How is that in any world okay?
You refer to 10-4, some places call them visual inspections, but there's always a euphemism. One parent said, talking about the fact that there is less of this constant intrusion now, ironically, because of COVID-19. So some of the visits are being made and the surveillance is being done virtually. And this mother said, yeah, at least now when it's on a Zoom call, they don't make me strip search the child because that would be child pornography.
Oh my goodness. Well, let's end the conversation with the COVID-19 discussion. We've both read, and I know you've written about this, but we both read sort of inflammatory articles about, oh my gosh, all these kids who are home from school now, there's going to be so much more child abuse because teachers are the primary reporters of child abuse. And without that additional surveillance of kids in school, all these kids home with parents are at greater risk. What do you say to that?
I say it's a perfect example of a phrase I only learned a couple of weeks ago, health terrorism. And what that means is, and this was said by somebody who works for an agency, which were at one time were masters of the art of health terrorism. So it's their own phrase about what they used to do. And it means deliberately hyping and scaring people with extreme horror stories that are not representative of the whole in order to, quote, raise awareness. Well, that's been done for at least 50 years now. So people have grown up on that. So it's easy to believe that there is a child abuser under every bed and that beating and torturing children is rampant. So therefore, and that the only thing that stands between that, the children and this torture, are the constant eyes and constant surveillance of mandated reporters. Again, that's Elizabeth Bartholet's party line. So what you get is, and what's interesting is, how many people have picked up on this and used this without also considering the racial bias and class bias overtones? Because these professionals are disproportionately going to be white and middle class. Their eyes are going to be on children who are overwhelmingly poor and disproportionately non-white. So what they are really saying is, the moment white middle-class professionals have their eyes averted from overwhelmingly poor, disproportionately non-white kids, those kids' parents will unleash upon them a, and the phrase has actually been used, pandemic of child abuse. The racial and class bias in that should be obvious. But unfortunately, this has become the master narrative of COVID and child welfare. And what adds a danger to it, we've talked about all the other dangers of these needless investigations and intrusion on families. Now there's another danger. Every time you go into that house and poke and pry and look into all the cupboards and the refrigerator and go upstairs and downstairs and into every closet, you are increasing the risk of spreading COVID-19, both to families and among caseworkers themselves. So it creates still another danger.
Well, Richard, this has been very interesting. If people want to learn more about your work, where can they go?
We are at nccpr.org, and our child welfare blog is at nccprblog.org.
Well, thank you very much to my guest, Richard Wexler. And once again, I'm Jim Mason, president of Parental Rights Foundation. And you can find me and my work at parentalrightsfoundation.org. Thanks again, Richard.
Thank you.